Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm David Lair, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Susan Shirk. Dr. Shirk is the chair of the 21st Century China Center and a research professor at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at University of California in San Diego. She's also director emeritus of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. And Dr. Shirk first visited China in 1971, I believe was part of the first group of American students invited over there, and has been researching, writing, and traveling to China ever since. She also served for several years as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs. And in addition to all that, I had the opportunity to be one of her students at UCSD many, many years ago. So let me welcome Dr. Shirk to the stage.
Thanks so much. Well, thank you so much, David. It's one of the joys of being a university professor to have your students introduce you later on and to see how all the great contributions they're making after they leave your classroom. Well, when I served in the Clinton administration, I helped negotiate China's WTO agreement, its accession to the World Trade Organization. At dinner one night in 2000, I sat with Charlene Barshefsky, who is the lead negotiator, and I said to her, we'll know that our strategy of engaging China has succeeded when the biggest problem in U.S.-China relations is economics and trade, rather than the other issues that we were struggling with then, like nuclear nonproliferation, missile nonproliferation, and human rights. Well, we certainly are there today. Economics and trade is right at the center of the tension in U.S.-China relations. Today, President Trump imposed 10% tariffs on added to the ones that he did previously, more than half of all Chinese exports to the United States. And President Xi Jinping is likely to hit back on what could be 80% of Chinese exports to China. And at the same time, the U.S. and China are in the midst of a very serious conflict over China's high-tech industrial policy. And both countries seem to be headed to try to disentangle themselves from the economic interdependence that binds them together today, which would, of course, disrupt international production chains that I have come to believe are the economic base for global prosperity and peace over the past several decades. So the U.S.-China relationship has definitely entered into a phase of strategic competition. But the policies adopted by the Trump administration don't knit together in any kind of coherent way. Instead of creating incentives for China to adopt a more fair and equitable set of economic policies, the Trump administration's approach appears to be designed to decouple the two economies. And the Chinese leadership has, and probably much of the public, has determined that the Trump actions are aimed at containing China's rise rather than actually trying to solve problems in the economic relationship. So for someone like me who's been working pretty much my whole career on trying to build a constructive relationship between U.S. and China. It's a very upsetting time, a very disturbing time, because I do feel, you saw the title of my talk, Preventing Cold War II. I do feel that we stand at the brink of a new Cold War between the United States and China. And this Cold War could be even worse than the first Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, because the U.S. and China are already so intertwined with one another, economically, socially, technologically, educationally, and also that we're living in an era of globalization. So a hostile rupture that is in which the conflict is primarily over economics and technological competition would inevitably disrupt the global economy. I mean, right now, the U.S. stock market has been surprisingly buoyant considering this risk, this threat. But I don't know how long. We'll see what happens with the announcement of this latest round of tariffs. So, you know, economic interdependence has motivated the two countries to try to cooperate with one another because they need one another economically. But now, increasingly, what we see is what Brookings scholar Thomas Wright has called the weaponization of interdependence, in which the two countries are starting to pursue exclusionary policies to reduce the vulnerability they feel toward one another and the threat they feel from one another. People often say to me, you know, but U.S. and China are not really likely to go to war, are they? So we don't really have to worry too much about it. But this kind of hostile, peaceful competition could be just as damaging to U.S. interests as an actual military conflict. So this is the moment I feel that we really have to head off a new Cold War by, on the U.S. side, devising a firm and patient strategy for non-hostile, healthy competition. We don't have to fear competition. And in America, you know, we should feel confident about our ability to compete successfully in a way that protects our interests and values, but still preserves the mutual benefit of our interdependence, and also maintains space to cooperate on issues like climate change that are of vital importance to both countries and to other folks in the world. So the Trump tariffs, in my opinion, are just completely wrongheaded approach and potentially very harmful to our own economy as well as to U.S.-China relations. What's the goal of these tariffs? It appears that what Trump cares the most about, and advisors like Peter Navarro, is narrowing the bilateral trade deficit, even though 99.9% of all economists will tell you that bilateral trade deficits really have no impact on national welfare. Is the goal then just to change, get China, to get leverage on China, to change its protectionist policies to get more fair treatment for U.S. firms, which is actually what the business community cares most about? But Trump doesn't want U.S. firms operating in China. He wants to bring them back to the United States. So this is very confusing. What is really the objective of the tariffs? Several times, Trump cabinet members have try to negotiate with China. They get some agreement. They bring it back to President Trump. He says, I don't want it. I don't want the agreement. I want my tariffs. He likes the idea of tariffs, but it's very unclear to the Chinese side, as well as to all of us, as to what is really the objective of these tariffs. And also the Chinese side's very confused about with whom can they negotiate? Who is a credible negotiator? Because the Trump economic team appears to be very divided over what the objective actually is. And none of them can actually say, because they know that ultimately it comes down to what the president is deciding on any particular day. Now, I had the opportunity to spend some time with Steve Bannon because I chair a task force on U.S.-China policy back last spring. And he believes that Trump won the election because in the red states, he came down very hard on how China was victimizing the American economy. So he really believes that the electoral victory in the presidential election was due to targeting China. And I think that if you look under the surface here, what is President Trump trying to do with these tariffs is basically continuing to try to win votes for the midterm elections is the only logic I can see underlying it. But, you know, the tariffs are the wrong approach, but we do have serious economic and technological competition with China now. And there are ways in which Chinese policies have really created a very serious concern that goes beyond the Trump administration and even go to Congress. It goes to both parties, and it goes beyond the United States to Europe and Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. And our 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego has a great team of economists and political scientists who are trying to understand how China actually works and how it makes its economic policy. So back in February, we organized a small discussion on how should the United States handle this competition, and in particular, how should we handle the review and regulation of China's high-tech investments in the United States. So we had the head of CFIUS, the interagency body that reviews foreign investment. We had the counterpart officials in the European Union, in Japan, in Canada, as well as a number of other European countries. And what really struck me was that in every advanced industrial country, not just in the United States, countries feel threatened by China in national security terms and in economic and technological competitiveness. So why, the question that I want to focus on today is, why is China, does China appear to be so threatening to all the advanced industrial countries? And what should we, what's the smart way to go to deal with it, to respond to it? The most important thing is that since about 2006, this actually starts before the Xi Jinping period, China is engaged in a massive government-organized and funded, lavishly funded drive to acquire foreign technology to make itself into a high-tech superpower. Now, the drive to acquire foreign technology started all the way back in the 1970s. But this effort to invest overseas as part of the effort to bring technology back to China is relatively new. I mean, and it's very significant that China is really the first non-OECD, non-democratic country in our modern history to have become a major foreign investor. And we're all figuring out how to cope with that. And when China started going out to invest overseas a few years ago, it was primarily focused on energy resources. But now, by 2016, very quickly, the largest share of China's investment, its mergers and acquisitions, targeted the high-tech sector. Now, in 2017, outbound investment went down because they put capital controls on. But very significantly, the one area that was exempted from the capital controls is investment in high technology. So, of course, that leads us to see very clearly that China Incorporated, the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, are encouraging this kind of outbound investment in technology. And they are funding it amply, too. One of my colleagues, economist Barry Naughton, has calculated that the government guidance funds for high-tech investments are $1.5 trillion. Now, that money isn't all going to foreign investment. A lot of it's going for domestic tech development. But the Chinese state is huge. Frankly, the Chinese state is too big. Barry estimates that the Chinese state has about 40% of GDP available for it to dispense as it wants. And that's compared to 24% for the United States and 36% in Germany. So the Chinese state is using these big guidance funds to drive this high-tech development. And this is not a normal industrial policy in which the government invests in and guides market activity. It's much more state-driven, and it explicitly articulates the Chinese dominance of certain sectors domestically in China and internationally. So plans like Made in China 2025 aim at having 70% Chinese content of core components and materials by 2025, which is, before we know it, it'll be 2025. So, of course, international firms now have leading positions along the production chains of many of these high-tech sectors. So they wonder, well, what does this mean for us? And the policies that the Chinese state pursues put systemic limits on the operation of foreign competitors in domestic markets. And this is, you know, to give the Trump administration its due, the U.S. Trade Representative's office has done an analysis of this, which frankly is quite good. And both Democrats and Republicans and many of the China experts agree with their diagnosis of what the problem is. The question is, how do we get China to adjust its policies in a way that is more fair and less biased against foreign firms? AIG Chairman Hank Greenberg, who is a longtime China hand, wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal recently in which he said, and he's always a big booster of U.S.-China relations, discriminatory treatment of foreign firms is embedded in the Chinese bureaucracy now. There is no real national treatment, meaning when China has these special subsidies and investments, it's only the national Chinese firms who really can benefit from it, not the international firms. And there's also this pressure on international firms to transfer their technology as the price to do business in China. You may have read recently, I was struck by this story that Toyota is reportedly in talks to transfer its wonderful Prius hybrid technology to a major Chinese firm in order to compete in the auto market in China. And, you know, again, the Chinese government has put a very high priority, major big push industrial policy on electric vehicles. But now they're realizing that 100% electric vehicles, this may be slower progress than they would hope. So they are thinking, well, we better get some good hybrid technology to fill in the gap before we have complete electric car technology. Another reason that China is viewed, China's policies are creating this backlash in all the advanced industrial countries is that China's market reforms and opening have stalled out. Until a decade or so ago, China was pursuing economic policies convergent with our market ideas and curtailing the role of the state in the economy. You know, they dismantled central planning. They tried to build a competitive market economy. The state withdrew from the economy compared with the Mao era. But, and of course, U.S. policies, including our welcoming China into the World Trade Organization, helped reinforce these choices that Chinese themselves were making to develop a market economy and open up to the world economy. And of course, it was hugely successful. But the fact of the matter is that China today, their economy is diverging from this economic logic to have this much more state-led kind of state capitalist system. You know, President Xi Jinping goes to Davos or to Boao forums, and he talks about open global markets and especially with the United States under Trump kind of abdicating from our leadership of World Trade Organization and other global economic institutions. You know, this creates an opening for China to step up. And Xi Jinping gives these speeches that sound really great, wonderful rhetoric. But the reality is that inside China, China's reversing course and pursuing a kind of import substitution, high-tech industrialization policy. You know, what's happening in China politically also is contributing to the international backlash because China's making a U-turn in its domestic politics as well as its economic system. It's party, Communist Party control over policymaking and over the economy is strengthening. And we have this personalistic leadership of Xi Jinping, who since the Party Congress last fall is proclaiming the superiority of the Chinese system to market democracies and making the competition between our systems and values much more explicit than it was in the past. I've been to China in a few times in recent months, and I've been struck by people, including people who are Communist Party theorists or officials who are really, were really unhappy about Xi Jinping's having these constitutional change to eliminate the two-term limit for the presidency, and declaring so overtly his goals to remain in power, perhaps for life. This is going back to the days of in which you have dictatorial leadership, sclerotic leadership. The only way to get rid of them is through some kind of violent power struggle or take them out feet first after they get old and die. So people realized that they actually valued the progress that had been made in China politically. I mean, it wasn't democratization, but it was a more rule-bound institutional version of communist rule. The other thing is that China's efforts to become a high-tech superpower are very clearly bound up with Xi Jinping's efforts to build the Chinese military into a formidable force that can fight and win wars. There's a whole policy of civil-military integration in high-tech development, which certainly contribute to the widespread perception of a threatening China. So what should we do about it? You hear me as a old China hand making these observations about how China works today. And there are many of my colleagues who've been studying China for years share this critique of how Chinese policies, which start before Xi Jinping, but have taken a more extreme form under Xi Jinping of making a U-turn to a more state-led system, economically, politically, more party-led system, and diverging more and more from global norms. I'm critical of this, but I am all the more worried about our ability to respond in a smart manner that doesn't end up harming ourselves as much as China. I think we are very much in danger of overreacting to this now. You know, some member of Congress, I read how he said Congress does two things well: do nothing and overreact. Well, I think in respect to China policy, we're in a phase of overreacting. So what should we be doing? What are some suggestions about a better way to move forward than the Trump tariffs or some of the new laws that Congress is putting in place to try to disentangle us from the Chinese economy? Number one, let's heal ourselves. Let's, first of all, have more investment in research and education in America. If we're going to compete successfully with China, when you look at the rates of investment in R&D, American R&D, especially from government, it's declined. And so I'm hoping that maybe this can be a Sputnik moment in which instead of trying to create new barriers against China, we take some positive initiatives to strengthen our own capabilities. Second, I don't think the answer is to try to copy China's state-led industrial policy. I still remember when we were competing with Japan and everybody thought in the 70s and 80s, and everybody thought, oh, Japan is beating America because it's got this more government-led approach to industrial development. But actually, in the end, the U.S. market-based, flexible, firm, commercially-driven, firm-driven international production chains enabled the U.S. economy to recover while the Japanese economy stalled out and is still stalled out. So let's not try to copy what China's doing and follow that approach.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Third, national security concerns are real and very legitimate. But if we're going to restrict Chinese investment in the United States, let's narrow the scope to the technologies that are of direct utility to defense. Let's not expand it to every high-tech field, including biomedical technology and AI broadly based. I mean, if we try to keep out all Chinese investment and all Chinese students in artificial intelligence, we'll end up robbing ourselves of the talent and the that we really need for our own economy. So I like the idea of former Defense Secretary Gates in talking about export controls a few years ago. He proposed a way of thinking about what kinds of technologies we should limit our exports of. And he said, think about a smaller yard and higher fence. So let's limit it to the technologies that are directly connected with military defense and not define critical technologies too broadly. Fourth, let's not create a perception in China that all we're doing is pursuing technological containment of China, trying to just keep China down, keep China's, impede its progress and keep it weak. And frankly, this is the interpretation that the Chinese leadership and many Chinese people now have, that we are just engaged in a policy of containment. We're not trying to actually get China to make some modifications of the way it does things. Instead, we're just trying to keep them down. And that is going to lead to a hostile retaliation on Chinese part. So I think we should think about levers that can induce positive change in China, and that I believe we could be negotiating right now on some of the way it conducts industrial policy. I don't think it's so hard-baked into the Chinese system that we couldn't, on the basis of norms of fairness and market competition, improve market access for American firms. Six, we should be coordinating with our friends and allies. This idea that America is going to do this alone is really misguided. And so our government should be working closely with other advanced industrial countries to devise a kind of common approach, especially to how we manage Chinese investments. And the Trump administration, by undervaluing our alliances, by alienating our allies, by calling into question or withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, from other trade agreements. We're undercutting our own ability to work with friends and allies on a kind of common approach to shaping China's choices. Seventh, I really think we have to be very cautious about trying to exclude Chinese investment and exclude Chinese scholars and students. This could have a very damaging impact on our own society. Trying to disentangle our economies, our educational systems, will harm the vibrancy of our own innovation ecosystem. So I believe we ought to be competing for, you know, there are all these talented people in China. I think it's great they come here to study, and I think we should try to encourage them to stay, build companies, and help contribute to America. If we start putting barriers up to Chinese entrepreneurs, investors, students, visiting scholars, which is the direction we're headed in right now, this is going to result in kind of hounding people back to China. And for example, right now, there's a lot of politicians talking about this 1,000 talent program. That is a program that the Chinese government, actually, I'm not happy about the fact that this program is under the organization department of the Chinese Communist Party. And the idea is to get outstanding Chinese, American, and Chinese in other countries, but especially America, those scientists or whatever, to come back to help build scientific research programs in China, too. And, you know, there are a lot of great people who are very loyal American citizens who just like the idea of helping cultivate talent in China. And so they have one foot in America and one foot in China. And these people are already becoming the object of suspicion that they are somehow disloyal to the United States. And I'm really worried that this new Cold War is going to put a lot of suspicion on every Chinese American, similar to the Red Scare in the first Cold War. You already heard the FBI director, Christopher Wray, just a couple of weeks ago, describe China as a whole-of-society threat to the United States. He says people are starting to wake up to this threat. To me, this sounds like Joe McCarthy. And I find it very worrisome. So the question today is, can America feel confident enough in itself, which I think it should. We have every reason to believe that our system can compete well with the Chinese system, just as we competed with Japan in the past. And, you know, our open society and our market-based economy have tremendous strengths. And instead of erecting all sorts of barriers or trying to punish China, I think we should be negotiating with China to find, to get China to adjust its approach, its policies. I think that's possible. And prevent overreactions on our side, which will harm the openness and vibrancy of our own society, which is the ultimate source of American competitiveness. And so I always feel that our best competitive strategy for healthy competition with China is to strive to be a better version of our democratic selves rather than becoming more like China. So I think I'll stop there and open it up to questions and answers.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shirk. I just want to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Preventing Cold War II, a game plan for healthy competition with China, with Dr. Susan Shirk.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir. Wait. Hold on. Here comes the mic.
Early in your speech, you used the word incentives. We should figure out ways to give the Chinese some incentives to change their ways. And then you listed your seven things we should do. Maybe in one or two of those, there was kind of a reference to incentives, but not really. Could you expand upon the concept of incentives for the Chinese to actually change?
Well, you know, I do believe that there is a need to push back. You know, that I believe that we should join with other countries, for example, to go to the WTO. And although some of the non-tariff barriers inside China against foreign companies are not really covered by WTO rules, there is a general WTO expectation when China joined the WTO that it would be reducing the role of the state in the economy. So there is a kind of systemic approach in which if we joined with other countries and went to the WTO, which is one thing that, you know, could happen, which I think would certainly get China's attention. I also believe that some tariffs or retaliation could be helpful to get the attention of the Chinese leaders. And then once you do that, get a real negotiation going. But that's not what the Trump administration has done. So, you know, I believe that some pressure is necessary. But I don't believe that these massive punitive tariffs are the way to go about it. Yes, sir.
Yes. Could you clear up the problem with China stealing our intellectual property? What is that all about? China stealing our intellectual property. Trump always alludes to that. And
yeah. So it's certainly the case that there is commercial espionage that's gone on for a long time. And, of course, all countries engage in espionage, but China and a few other countries, like at least it used to be France used to do this too. I'm not sure if they do it anymore. But government actually kind of encourages the theft or spying on commercial and technological secrets. And we need to stand very firmly against that, obviously. And we want the FBI to be on the job trying to track that down and punish that legally. I mean, they do it pretty well, and certainly they've beefed up their capability to do it. But the part that bothers me is when things like having Chinese students come over and get PhDs in American university laboratories, or Chinese investors coming in and buying a company in the United States is somehow viewed as technology theft. That's not theft. That's all legal activity. It may result in China some kind of leakage of Chinese know-how, you know, back to China. But that's kind of the price we pay from globalization, you know, and it's basically impossible to prevent that kind of thing without excluding Chinese expertise from coming to China, Chinese capital, I mean, to the United States, completely. And are we really willing to destroy the interdependence that has worked so well for us in the past and destroy our own society in the trying to do so?
That's a tricky problem.
It's a tricky problem, and I think we should take efforts to protect ourselves against real intellectual property theft, but not define what is intellectual all these legitimate activities as theft. Yes, back here.
Thank you. I'm sorry I showed up a little late because I was coming across the bridge. I work over in that place across the bay called the Port of Oakland. So this is really near and dear to our hearts and our wallets as a public agency. We've had a lot of very, very sobering phone calls with the California Farm Federation, Farm Bureau Federation, and others, especially out of the Central Valley. And one of the biggest concerns they have, of course, is that sourcing patterns are going to change. So walnuts are being produced out of Chile right now. They've got an over inventory. China's going to pick that up and maybe not come back to the United States and start sourcing. So how do you see this resolving itself, and how long before it resolves itself? Thank you.
Yeah, it's extremely worrisome because all of these supply chains, yeah, it's not necessarily that easy to shift sourcing very quickly. And American farmers and American manufacturers and American service providers will all pay a price, I believe. So I think it's will end up harming the U.S. economy. And how fast can these things go back? There's apparently soybean production in Brazil occurred. I'm trying to remember what some previous trade embargo or something occurred that led to that. And, you know, so it can really drastically disrupt and change the patterns of sourcing for the whole global economy. And how long will that continue? It's hard to say. It'll probably be long lasting, because even if tariffs get lifted, it's not clear that you can just turn on a dime and go back to the status quo ante. Yes.
I'm concerned about our setting this up like a race from the same starting point. So it would help to have some history, because you and I were young students in China at the same time in 71. Mm-hmm. So you remember how it was agriculturally based. Mm-hmm. And as you went on to your academic career and the fragile superpower, mm-hmm. I raised a family and had many immigrant relatives continue to immigrate from China, mm-hmm. which is another one of Trump's anti-immigrant mm-hmm. saws, okay? But there's another way of looking at the relationship, because this was Gold Mountain to many Chinese for many years, and the families that are established here, and mm-hmm. now many go back and forth. So getting the historical relationship right, the Chinese Exclusion Act happened after Chinese workers built the railroad, which created the United States mm-hmm. as an economic and political entity. And then we had the Burlingame treaty, where as an ambassador, he went back and forth trying to help build these relations. Yeah. If we could go back and try to get some of the history right so that China doesn't feel that it is looked down upon, having to catch up as this ancient agricultural economy. So if you remember Premier Zhu Rongji, he made a comment once, which was, you have to sew a lot of sneakers to buy a Boeing airplane. And so China's had to go through these stages,
yeah,
as many of the other, we call them underdeveloped third world countries, but it's a post-Western imperialism world. I think if we could get some of the historical relationships set right, that the dialogue now could be more honest, more respectful.
Thank you very much. Very good observation. I don't think there was a question there, but it was a good observation. Yes, how about right here?
I'm just wondering, you partially answered, what is the economic engine that is driving China to have this incredible amount of wealth to be able to invest in other countries, to invest in their technology? They seem to be limitless. They build new cities with the drop of a hat. We're an economic power, and we can't repair a bridge.
Yeah.
How are they generating so much wealth?
Well, Chinese economy has grown very rapidly over more than three decades. It had basically double-digit GDP growth for more than three decades, which is really historically unprecedented. And the main driver of that rapid growth is that you had a society that was 80% rural, and you took these folks and put them behind a factory in a city, and GDP is going to grow. So some of it is the wisdom of Deng Xiaoping, China's former leader, who realized that if you lifted the state from dominating the economy, central planning, and let market unleashed market forces, that China's pretty well-educated population would go into industrial development and the economy, and you opened it up to foreign investment to get more capital and know-how of how to export, and the economy just took off. It's basically just unleashed market forces and opening China to the world. Now that growth is slowing down, has to slow down inevitably because of demography. One of the reasons that it grew so rapidly is it had about 70% of the population was working age, with a very low dependency rate of older people and children. Now China's starting to get older, and that's inevitably leading to somewhat slower growth. And so the challenge that China's policymakers face is, you know, how to sustain growth, take care of the welfare of an aging population, educate the population. I mean, I heard some interesting complaints in China when I've been there recently about, I mentioned that Chinese government controls 40% of GDP. So they're putting all this money into a trillion, you know, more than $1 trillion to become a high-tech superpower. But what about investing more in public goods like education, healthcare, and pensions? Chinese education is underfunded. The central government keeps saying we want to spend so much on education, but they never do. And so there are a lot of needs in China. Environmental cleanup. One, as China was growing so rapidly, they poisoned their environment and their population. So they have a lot of work to do. And there are many people in China who think that these priorities of this hypercharged, you know, high-tech industrialization policy are the wrong priorities. Of course, they're proud of China's achievements, but they have a lot of other things they'd like to see the Chinese government doing. Yes.
How worried is the Chinese government about the hundreds of millions of Chinese who are still living in poverty?
Well, President Xi Jinping has a poverty alleviation initiative. And they've given quotas to counties that they must alleviate, lift so many people out of poverty, and they've got a line, but they really haven't told them how to do that. So, I think leaders in China are concerned about poverty and they're concerned about inequality. I don't think it's necessarily the number one objective, but it is something that the Xi Jinping government has talked quite a lot about recently. Yes, sir.
We went through this with Japan, and 30 years ago? And they didn't work out too well in the end for Japan. With all the money they invested in America, mm-hmm. they ended up eating. And then in the second place is America, with all its faults, people are not migrating to China. They're migrating to America. So if China was so great, and if the media would back off a little bit, the truth about China would surface, and I think these fears are overestimated.
I agree.
And I'd like you to comment on that, because America is still America. And when America comes together, I don't want to be in the way. We just have not rallied. And we may rally and we may not, but I don't want, and so all this Chinese talk sells newspapers and magazines, but the reality is they are nowhere near being as civilized as America.
Well, I don't want to comment on civilized, but I will comment on
civilized. I mean, the social programs that we take care of, they're not taking
right.
care of.
Right.
That's what I mean by civilized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not by culture and all those kinds of, that's an old culture. You got a long way to go.
Well, I totally agree with you that we should be more confident. That's one of the takeaways, I hope, from what I said here tonight, is that we shouldn't be so fearful that we can't compete without taking these quite radical measures to disentangle our two economies. I just think it's going to be very damaging to ourselves in every way, values-wise as well as interests.
Thank you. I've read different articles that compare and contrast the strength of each country in terms of this negotiation or this trade war. And some people have said that democracies are at a disadvantage because they have to appeal to the populace on a regular basis, whereas Xi Jinping does not. Do you have a comment or thoughts on the relative negotiating power of each player in this situation?
Well, I think it's definitely true. That's a very good question. It's definitely true that divisions, social divisions, and the divisions between different interest groups, there are going to be winners and losers. Not too many winners, but some are going to lose more than others. And that is a challenge. But I'm watching very closely what's happening in China. It's not, originally, people in China were actually, even now, kind of like President Trump. And just today, I was talking to some Chinese friends who are saying that there are so many people in China, especially educated, urban, economic elites, private business people, academics, they have a lot of problems with Xi Jinping's policy, making this U-turn back to, in political terms and in economic terms, and the primacy on the state-owned enterprises and really putting pressure on private enterprises. So they think that it's hard to have checks and balances in China checks on this personalistic leadership. They don't have a legislature that can really do it. They don't have an independent legal system. You can't do it just within the party because everybody is frankly afraid that if you speak critically, they're going to accuse you of corruption or something and throw you into jail. So therefore, they see that the international pressure on China kind of maybe can help bring about some changes inside China. And it's triggered a whole debate is too strong. Most of it is private discussion, but some is much more open. Like today, I was just reading about a meeting of the leading reform economists in China. And they were very critical of current policy for diverging from this path of market reform that China under Deng Xiaoping took for such a long time. And I hear this in the universities as well. So, you know, it's some people say the fact that China's kind of hit a wall in terms of the international backlash might have some positive impact on adjustments in the future. So let's wait and see.
Our thanks to Dr. Susan Shirk, chair of the 21st Century China Center and research professor at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, for her comments today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening at home. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 115th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.